You say you did it. I say you didn't. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. I say you got lucky. You say I didn't try. So you say it all worked. I say not for me. You say I didn't try. I say you just don't see why. You say I didn't try. I ask, can't you cry? You ask, why should I? I ask as I sigh. Why can't you see it? If we exist as I, too few will make it if we are only I. Folks, that's the whole question in life is how much do we care about others and how much do we sacrifice a little bit to make our world a better place? We're going to talk about all kinds of issues on this show. This is the Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, and I'm your host, Alan Jennings. Folks, I just was coming in from my car in the parking lot at WDIY, and as I'm walking through the lot, in comes a car with a guy driving it. In the back seat, three little kids, school-age kids. He gets out of his car, leaves the kids in the car, runs across the street to New Bethany Ministries, where if I weren't in a hurry, I could tell you if I stayed and watched, what I would have watched was his bringing breakfast out for his kids from New Bethany Ministries. If that's not a motivator to take a look at what our world is all about and where it's going and whether we have any hope for our future, that does it right there. I'm Alan Jennings, and I'm your host on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Discourse. I've had the opportunity to do, I think, three shows now leading up to the election. Today I have the honor, and you have the honor and the privilege of listening to our former Congressman, Charlie Dent, probably the most colorful, most decorated, most well-known elected official in Lehigh Valley for anybody who's alive today. Charlie's been through the state House, he's been through the state Senate, he's served in the United States Congress, and now he's out on the loose, emancipated from that, working as a commentator with CNN. You're still doing CNN, aren't you, Charlie?
Yeah, correct.
Welcome to the show, my friend. It's good to have you.
Alan, great to be with you, and congratulations on an extraordinary career. You made a real difference and had an enormous impact. You should be proud of that and all the people that you served and helped improve their lives. So congratulations on that great career.
Well, Charlie, I appreciate that very much. You know, are you allowed to be my friend these days? I guess when you're not elected, it doesn't matter anymore. But, you know, it used to be that Democrats and Republicans talked to each other. You were friends. You went golfing. You had dinner with your spouses. And those days are over, I guess. You know, if you have a friend who's on the other side, you're like some kind of evil person, right?
Well, that's it still happens, obviously, but it's harder to do it out in the open. I mean, almost at times they almost have to do it in the closet. I remember at times being criticized. I was criticized by some Republicans for going to a Super Bowl party at the White House after Barack Obama was elected president in 2008. This was in, you know, February of 2009. He'd only been in office for a few weeks, and I got invited to the Super Bowl to watch Super Bowl at the White House with the president. I said yes, and people said, "How could you? I do such a thing."
Yeah, well,
and I said, It's football.
Well, you know, you and I are both the kind of people who want to know everybody who's consequential, who can help us make a difference. And, you know, you make a point of making those connections. And so why wouldn't a freshman congressman take full advantage of an opportunity to meet the president of the United States and maybe even establish some rapport that might be beneficial to the country and your constituents, right?
Yeah. I was a third term congressman at that moment, but
it
was still.
Term.
But
wow.
At that, yeah, I came in 2004, and this is in 2008, or actually February of 2009. But I mean, but that's the kind of thing you just deal with these days. That you know, there are people out there who just kind of are very tribal, and you know, you can't mix with the other tribe.
Well,
that's how they view it.
And then we've got this freak, you know, I mean, who just takes everything off the charts. You can't make any predictions. There's nothing that's, you know, that's stayed anymore, nothing reverent about anything anymore. It's all up in the air with this president. You were brave enough to endorse Joe Biden. But I remember when you were one of the first public figures to really be like viciously attacked by the president because you had the nerve to make some comments that were sympathetic to the Affordable Care Act. Wasn't that the issue?
The issue, Alan,
you were going to destroy the Republican Party.
Yeah. He was upset with me during the repeal replace debate. He was upset because I tried to explain to him the problems with the bill that was under consideration by the House, that the Medicaid changes were too rough for states like ours that had expanded Medicaid. And, you know, and I actually handed him a letter from four Republican governors that said, it's, you know, we, you know, here are some suggested changes to the Medicaid provisions. And, you know, he didn't seem to be particularly interested. And he, you know, then I also pointed out some other challenges with the tax credits that were available, you know, were not sufficient for people going on the exchanges. They wouldn't be able to afford them, so they would lose coverage. And, you know, so he kind of got really out of sorts over the whole thing. And basically, that I was going to destroy the Republican Party. That was going to be my fault. He would blame me. You know, the world as we knew it was going to end. You know, his administration was over. Tax reform was done. I mean, you know, on and on and on it went. And I pushed back a few times, and it was just a bizarre encounter. You know, that one was in the cabinet room. I had one meeting with him in the Oval Office where he actually was trying to be very gracious and charming. And, you know,
right.
He was
gracious,
you know, hey.
Gracious and charming. Donald Trump was gracious.
Yeah.
And charming.
You know, it's funny. I've seen both. I can see good Donald and bad Donald. I mean, I saw him, you know, he can be very charming when he wants to be. Hmm. And then he can be a total, you know, total bully and a jerk.
Yeah.
I mean, he can go back and forth. I mean, so,
yeah,
but, just a different, it was really a very bizarre, encounter. And it just kind of led me to believe that he really didn't have the temperament or the fitness, or frankly the intellectual capacity to do the job. I mean, he just he has certain instincts that he follows, and I found that, you know, I could see in the meeting with him, I could see the impulse control issues, the ADD, the narcissism, the volcanic temper.
Oh,
he could
man.
See it all. But he doesn't have much of a policy interest. You know, he's just not emotionally, intellectually, or temperamentally, you know, really well suited for the job.
I mean, well, he makes things up. I mean, you know, he just says whatever he wants to say. I mean, the way he's demonized Joe Biden is just unbelievable. Joe Biden could have been a Republican 25 years ago or 30 years ago, right? I mean, he's a pretty moderate guy for a Democrat, isn't he? Don't you think?
If I had to label him, I'd label him, you know, kind of center left. That was always kind of where he was. I think, you know, in this election, he's probably been, you know, he's been tugged further to the left, but he's always kind of been more of a center left kind of politician. That's where he's been. And I think he's, you know, that's the pressure he's under now, you know, that, you know, should he win? And I think he will. He shouldn't misread the mandate. I mean, I don't think the mandate is to go Medicare for all or Green New Deal or,
yeah,
even, you know, packing the court. I think the mandate is, you know, they want to get rid of Trump and they want Joe Biden to, you know, steady the ship of state, so to speak, and kind of return us to some semblance of normalcy. Not go back to where we were, but just to bring about some, you know, better level of civil discourse and, you know, administration of the government.
Charlie, one of the things that my observation, you know, you and I have been, I mean, we've done this for a long time, but, you know, I've been doing this for, it's going on 40 years in another month or so. What I have observed is that the Democrats, you know, what is it, Will Rogers, who said, I'm not a member of any organized political party, I'm a Democrat. You've got that perspective. The Democrats just can't, you know, get a consensus all the time against the Republicans, who are just unbelievably disciplined and line up on behalf, you know, with their leadership in ways that I can't believe. I mean, these are the elites of our country, the United States Senate. And they are just like almost in diapers and dealing with Mitch McConnell. You know, I have a lot of good friends who are Republicans. In fact, I would argue that Republican business leaders in Lehigh Valley were probably my best allies over these 40 years. You know, they'd get mad at me because I'd speak out on something or other, but they were right there leading, you know, responsibly, progressively, on behalf of their community. But when you get a bunch of Republicans together and put them in a room and call them a party, I got to tell you, I hate these people. You know, McConnell and his handling of the Supreme Court nomination is just an outrage. How does it pull off that discipline like the Democrats could learn a lot from?
Well, the discipline, I mean, I guess if you look at it a little more broadly, I mean, before Trump came on the scene, I served in the House when John Boehner was Speaker, and you want to talk about lack of discipline, just go look at the House Republican Conference. You know, we had a group at that time, you know, the Freedom Caucus, that did everything in their power to undermine whatever the Republican speaker wanted to do. I mean, they would use their votes to, you know, impede progress or moving forward on any legislation because it wasn't quote conservative enough. Generally, was their argument. So I've seen the breakdowns in discipline too. You know, in the Senate. You know, I guess on the Supreme Court, I kind of take a longer view. I felt that both parties have not behaved well for years on this. That you know, then I thought, you know, years ago the Democrats would weaponize these Supreme Court nominations, and you know, starting with Bork. Whether you like Bork or not, really,
isn't
the issue.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I mean, whether you like him or not isn't the issue. I mean, he was certainly intellectually qualified, and
you bet, yep.
You know, had a. And he was, you know, and they weaponized it on ideological grounds, and came the Clarence Thomas hearings, and of course, you know, with the whole Anita Hill, and then the Kavanaugh. And so Democrats have been pretty good at weaponizing it. Now, I think what the Republicans did with Merrick Garland or what McConnell did, I disagreed with. They should have held hearings for that man, at the very least, and given some level of consideration to him back, you know, 4 years ago. I thought that was the case. But I was not shocked after the, you know, Justice Ginsburg's death that they rushed to fill the seat. Now, I always said, had the shoe been on the other foot, had it been a, you know, Republican justice who died, you know, 50 days out, Democrats would have rushed to fill it. I mean, they just would have if they're in the same predicament. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have waited until after the election. So, I mean, it's not pretty, but I mean, it is what it is.
Yeah. Well, so the packing of the court, you obviously think that that's a bad idea. I think that's a nuclear option that probably should be in play. What is the best argument for why they shouldn't do that?
Well, because you'll set off an arms race. I mean, you know, politics is such that sooner or later, you know, the tables will turn, Republicans will be in charge, and they'll say, you know what, we're going to pack the court. You know, we'll add three justices too. I mean, how do you end that? I mean, it's
yeah.
Like, I mean, I don't question the right of a party to want to add justices to the Supreme Court. That's well within their rights, but it doesn't mean they should do it. Now, I would argue if the Democrats are smart on this, they would, you know, I think Biden is, I agree with Biden, he wants to set up a commission to look at the court, but I think they ought to look at issues like maybe term limits on Supreme Court justices. There's nothing in the Constitution that would prevent that. You know, maybe an 18 year limit or a 21 year limit.
Yeah.
And maybe put an age limit on too. I mean, you know, God bless Justice Ginsburg. I mean, she, you know, was a trailblazer, but she was 87, and maybe we should put a retirement age at 78. You know, we have that in the state of Pennsylvania. It used to be 70. We raised it to 75. I think 70 is too young, you know, an age. But maybe you made 78 or 80. I mean, why not? And that way you could force some turnover,
right?
Either with a term limit.
It's like term limits on a board of directors. You know? I mean, it's just a good idea.
Yeah. And again, it could be a longer term limit. You know, these are lifetime appointments. You know, some of these folks get appointed fairly early, but I think that would at least get some churn, at least on the Supreme Court, and prevent situations where we have these Supreme Court justices staying beyond, you know, when they probably should have. I mean, and I think many recognize that, you know, Justice Ginsburg probably should have, you know, I mean, look, she was still mentally great, but her, you know, her health was not good.
Right.
And you know, many thought that she should have retired a few years ago, you know, so when Obama was president, so they could have replaced her then. But she didn't want to go. And the point is, I think if you have an age limit and a term limit, you get some churn on the court. And I think a lot of people would be receptive to that.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. Happy to be here. I've got my friend Charlie Dent on the line. If you heard a familiar voice and couldn't place it, Charlie's not been out of office for very long. I bet you're having a great time not having to campaign, Charlie, in this environment.
Yeah, and it's pretty tough. I mean, I feel badly for all these candidates trying to campaign because it's hard to campaign. I mean, how do you do it in a safe way? You can't really gather in crowds too often, or at least certainly not indoors.
Yeah,
so I think they're pretty much out of luck. They have to do everything virtually for the most part.
Did you see the New York Times article a few days ago where they made the argument that we are a nation that we're not a democracy, that we're being ruled, was the word I think they used, by a minority?
Oh, no, I didn't see that article. I'm sorry. I thought you were referring to the one that they focused on in the Sunday Times on the Lehigh Valley. Sunday, they interviewed a few people, including like Walt Dealtree and Bruce Haynes, you know, an interesting story about, you know, the presidential campaign. That's what I thought you were referring
to. No. But the article said, made the argument that that the country is essentially being controlled by the Senate, And the Senate, of course, is not representative because there are two from each state, whether it's a small rural state with no population or a big urban state with lots of people. And the argument, too, is that Donald Trump did not win the popular vote. So you got a president who didn't win the popular vote. You got a United States Senate that is elected by a minority of the population. This is not a democracy. This is a country being ruled by a minority. That's an interesting perspective that I thought.
Yeah, it is. But I never really agreed with it because, you know, having served in the House, I spent plenty of times in meetings where there was a lot of Senate bashing going on, usually because the Senate, because of their filibuster rules, it takes 60 votes to do just about anything over there.
Yep.
And, you know, House members would be impatient. And that time it was Republicans bashing the Senate, you know, when Harry Reid was ruling it. And I said, you know, they always want to get rid of the filibuster. And I get that it might need to be reformed. Don't misunderstand me. But I said, the day will come where you're going to be on the opposite side of that issue.
Yeah.
And you know, you have to have a little bit longer view. But the, at least in terms of the Senate, look, I think it was Benjamin Franklin who created the compromise for the U.S. Senate back in the day. And I mean, look, I always felt like the Senate was the price we had to pay for a republic, that we created a Senate. So that these small states would join the union. I mean, they were all worried about Pennsylvania and Virginia and Massachusetts at the time dominating, in New York dominating the Congress, and that they had to create this separate body where every state had equal representation. I think it was a very smart compromise. That was a compromise, you know, that was intended to create America. I mean, we might not have had a country as we know it today, but for that compromise. So I think any attempts to undermine the Senate's structure, I think, would be problematic. Now, that said, you know, there's talk about admitting new states, and, you know, I think the Democrats, you know, if they want to admit Puerto Rico as a state, well, they should, you know, at least let the people of Puerto Rico have a say in this matter.
I mean, yeah,
they
absolutely
have plebiscites. I mean, that's, you know, before. Now, Washington, D.C., I would oppose any type of statehood there because it really was never intended to be a state.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to give people that franchise for presidential races, then I would simply say, well, then just collapse the federal district and put the people back into Maryland. You know, the other half of the federal district was in Virginia, which Virginia reclaimed. I've forgotten the history of it, but the federal district included not only Maryland but Virginia. But Virginia, you know, reclaimed or was given back to Virginia. You could do the same thing. I'm not arguing we should do that. I'm just saying that if you really wanted to enfranchise the people of Washington, D.C., well, then you make them citizens of Maryland.
The argument is you add Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C., the Democrats will pick up four new senators.
Yeah.
That changes the whole yeah. thing.
Yeah, and they're always very careful to add. You know, look, I always thought that the district should have a seat in Congress that, you know, full rights. You know, I mean, I never agreed with statehood for Washington, D.C., but I understood that they should have a vote in the House. They have Eleanor Holmes Norton, who kind of votes the same way as the delegate from Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, and it can vote in committees but not in the floor. But I think D.C. should be given that seat. And we had an agreement, actually. And people questioned the constitutionality of this, by the way. But we were going to add a seat in Utah that would have been Republican, and then we would have added a seat in Washington, D.C., that would have been Democrat. And so we would have expanded the House by two seats. We were trying to do this like 10 years, more than 10 years ago. And maybe it was in 2007, I think we tried this. And I thought it was a pretty clever way to deal with it. But that is a little different than statehood. The federal district was created for a reason. And if you want to get rid of the district, we can get rid of it and put them back into Maryland.
Right. Your endorsement of Joe Biden, but what price have you paid for that? It costs your friends because you're not in politics anymore. You're not running for office anymore. You're obviously still in politics. Have you paid any kind of a price for that endorsement?
Some of my friends have been disappointed or upset or angry. I mean, that's true.
Like your former constituents.
Sure. But I've often told people, you know, disappointment's a two-way street.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people can be disappointed with me, but I said, but, you know, maybe I have a right to be disappointed with some of my other friends, too. I mean, I said, you know, I mean, is what, you know, and I would often have conversations with some of them and point out these problems with the president. And it's not like they disagreed with me. Yeah, we think he's a kind of a bad guy, too, they'll say. Or, you know, we don't agree with the way he handles himself and the tweets or he behaves abhorrently, and but you know, it's over a Supreme Court justice or a tax change or a regulatory issue. And I would say to them, you know, we agree on the facts. We've come to different conclusions. You know, their conclusion was that they should support him anyway after bad-mouthing him. I said, well, I came to the conclusion I should oppose him for the same reason. So that's what always kind of frustrated me with, you know, some of my friends. It's not like we're still friends. It's not like a lot of us. Some are angry. I mean, there's some, but the bottom line is they have a lot of people to be upset with. I mean, look at the, you know, former Governor Tom Ridge, former governor of Pennsylvania, former governor of Ohio Kasich, former governor of Michigan Snyder, have all, you know, endorsed Joe Biden. And I can, and I'm Governor Whitman. I mean, I can go straight across the country.
By the way, I had Christy, as she asked me to call her, on my show last week, and she was talking about her endorsement. She is the national chairwoman of Republicans and Independents for Biden. And she was very forceful, actually. And I asked her about her future in the party, and she said, I don't care. This is more important.
Look, there's going to be, I think, really, Alan, the bigger issue for all of us, as for Republicans, is after the election. Now, should Trump lose, and again, nobody likes to make predictions, but, you know, based on the polling, it appears that he will. And if the Senate flips to the Democrats and the House is, I think everybody agrees, the House is likely to remain Democrat. Then there's going to be a reckoning within the GOP, and they're going to be, you know, after the 2012 election, when Romney lost to Obama in that re-election in a reasonably close race, you know, the GOP at the national level, national committee, did a autopsy and made a lot of really good, serious recommendations about how to expand the base, appeal to LGBT people, Hispanics, and young people. I mean, a lot of really good common sense suggestions and ideas, and I think, you know, for a brief moment we were trying to implement it, and then, you know, along comes Donald Trump, and then he basically shredded it. Now, after this election, you know, should the GOP, you know, get beaten resoundingly, you know, there won't be another need for an autopsy, because, you know, we'll already know who killed the patient.
Yeah. Well, and there's no other Donald Trump on the planet, so it's not like you can say we're never going to have another Donald Trump, but, you know, this is a guy who has basically survived every possible scandal. Each individual scandal has knocked off former candidates for office like this. You know, women, financial, paying yourself off. You know, financial corruption, inappropriate foreign dealing. You know, sleeping with your enemy. You know, and Putin. What do you think not being presidential, he doesn't act presidential. He acts like a 14-year-old kid with a grudge. What do you think the long-term effect is going to be of the Trump presidency?
Hard to say, because, you know, I just always been astounded that the things that Donald Trump could get away with would have been career killers.
Yep.
Not just for politicians, but for people in, you know, in industry. Yep. And you know, workers. Workers. You know, CEOs, board members. All of them. You know, would have, they would have been terminated for any of these things. I mean, the comment just when he walked off the escalator and started, you know, bad mouthing Mexicans and calling them criminals and rapists and Muslim bans. You know, called John McCain he didn't like him because he wasn't a hero because he got captured. You know, fighting with a Gold Star family. I mean, questioning the loyalties of an Indiana judge who has a Mexican surname, or his family was originally from Mexico. I mean, doing all kinds of things. And you could go down a list. Charlottesville. I mean, the list just never ends. I mean, it just you think when you're about to hit rock bottom, you know, the bottom keeps falling out. And that was what's so stunning, and what's so amazing that he's been able to get away with. I think partly because a lot of people, you know, I think feel that they're tired of, you know, political correctness, and, you know, he's obviously anything but politically correct, and so a certain element of the base will reward him for it. But over time, I think it's really paid a heavy price. You look at all the polling, he's never been able to get over 50% on just about anything, you know, in terms of his favorabilities or approvals. He's always been stuck in the, usually, you know, on a good day at 45%, on a bad day he's about, in the high 30s.
Yeah.
And I think he's stuck. That's where he is.
Yeah. My anger is at a point where, I mean, I don't even watch CNN anymore. I watch MSNBC because it just fires me up so much. Denise is always trying to get me to turn it off because it makes me so mad. So I haven't seen you on CNN for a while. You're still the
I'll be on tomorrow night. I was on I was on Friday night. I was on Chris Cuomo Friday night, going on again tomorrow night. But because of the pandemic, they have done a lot more focus on the on the health issues, and so you see Sanjay Gupta all the time, and a lot of other medical experts who are speaking about that. So that's cut into the political time. But I expect over the next 2 weeks, you know, over election week, it's going to be pretty, I'll be pretty busy with CNN. So I go on, and you just don't know when I go on. I can go on early in the morning. I can go on late at night. I can go on in the middle of the day. It's a very, you know, they usually call you, you know, maybe, you know, sometimes the day before, sometimes the day of, hey, can you join us at, you know, such and such an hour, and you hop on. And so I can't really give people advance notice because the schedules change. You know, the, I was going to go on last night, actually, and they had to cancel me because the Amy Coney Barrett nomination was being completed right at that time.
Right.
That I was going to go on. So they had to change the program around, and that's just the way it is. So
now that you've been around and Pamela's gotten to know you a little bit better, are you still married?
Still married. All good. Happily married, and hadn't thrown me out yet, so it's all good. So it's all's good, and yeah, it's actually nice for me to actually spend some time in the house and not have to be, you know, running around the district of the country with my head cut off all the time in constant motion.
I ride my bike in Greenewalds a lot, and I always think of you and Pam.
Yeah, well, I've been doing a lot of bike riding, too, a lot of bike riding, and because my knees are, that's one thing, my knees are getting a little sore.
What happens?
A little arthritis.
I'm sorry.
But
you're getting arthritis in your knees.
And the one
so does that mean you're not running?
It's all right. I mean, I still play tennis. I don't run, but I do other exercises, so I still work out. But I'm just being a little more careful not to do too much pounding. So, riding the bike and doing the, I can still play tennis and stuff. That's fine. But I'm just being a little more careful with some of my activities. Completely functional, but just gets a little sore at times.
We've got about 2 minutes left. I wanted to give you an opportunity if you have an opinion on what happens in the Senate next week.
The Senate, I think the Senate is going to go the same way as the presidential race. Said the same thing in 2016, that the Senate would go the same way as the presidency. I think the state to watch is Georgia and the Senate.
Yeah.
Because you could have two races there that you have two Senate races. One's just because of the retirement of Johnny Isaacson, who was ill, and he left early. So you have two seats at the same time. Very unusual. And what will happen there is that it's likely that one seat will not get, nobody will get a majority. It'll be a plurality, but nobody will get over 50%, so there'll be a runoff in January. Uh-huh. It's likely that the second seat could result in a runoff. Mm-hmm. So there could be two seats in Georgia that will not be settled until January.
Wow,
they're
going to
have the final election. Yes.
I hadn't heard
and
of
so,
that.
So the balance of power in the Senate might not be known until Georgia is settled.
Hmm.
At least one of those seats will definitely go to the runoff, and maybe two. So keep an eye on Georgia. You know, Republicans are clearly playing defense. The Democrats are going to lose the Alabama seat for Doug Jones.
That's a given.
So that's gone. But Republicans obviously are, you know, have real problems in Arizona, Colorado. You know, Maine is a challenge. Iowa, North Carolina, and Montana.
Not Kentucky, huh?
No, I don't think so. Montana. Maybe even Alaska is a little bit in play. So watch those. Watch those, of course, the Georgia seats. So there's a lot. Lindsey Graham in South Carolina, although I think he probably wins, but it'll be closer than it ordinarily would be, obviously. But, you know, if Lindsey Graham were to lose, then those other states that I mentioned are likely to all go Democratic, too. I mean, I just don't know how. Usually that's the way these things go. And if there's kind of a wave type election, the wave tends to break one way. It usually doesn't break two ways. So it's, you know, when the news is usually pretty bad for one side or, you know, pretty all good for the other side.
Right.
That's how it typically goes.
Charlie Dent, my friend, you're a former congressman. If you hadn't, I'm sure you recognize the voice and you're trying to place it as our friend, Charlie Dent. Charlie, thanks so much for being active and continuing to play a role. Thanks for your longtime friendship, and we wish you the best.
Thanks, Alan. Great to be with you. Stay well, and congratulations on a great career.
Thanks. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. That was our former Congressman, Charlie Dent. Coming up, we have two corporate CEOs who are voting for Biden. I think most people expect successful CEOs to be on the Republican side of the equation. These two gentlemen are both on the Democratic side. We'll hear from them in just a moment. Stay with us.
Are you interested in inspiring and informing future generations through WDIY's programming? A gift through your will, retirement plan, or estate plan is a wonderful legacy to leave to those that will need a trusted place to hear what's going on in the world. For information about naming WDIY as a beneficiary, please call 610-694-8100 or visit wdiy.org/legacy.
Welcome back. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. And I now have on the phone with us two successful CEOs running very profitable, profitable might not be the right word, maybe it is, companies, both very prominent community leaders, both voting for Joe Biden. And I love this because it busts a sort of a stereotype of the corporate CEO who's the tough guy, Republican. And in both of these cases, as I said, very successful companies, very successful CEOs at the lead. One is Richard Master, who is the CEO of MCS Industries, which is a picture frame company that is based in Palmer Township. Richard Master, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Alan. And Charlie as well.
We've also got Charlie Marcon. He is the CEO of Dugan and Marcon. He's been in that business. It's a family-owned business. He's been in it since he was a kid, which was more than a few years ago. And Charlie and Richard are both friends, and they are both voting for Joe Biden. So let's start with asking how do you make the argument from a corporate perspective, because you're not going to do something, I don't think, in your personal life that's not good for the business. How do you end up being so different from your peers in voting for Joe Biden instead of Donald Trump this time? Charlie?
Well, first of all, I grew up a Republican, and My grandmother, God bless her, would roll over in a grave if she knew that I changed my registration to Democrat about 20 years ago. And I did that because I just was bothered by the fact that the Republicans were working very, very hard to increase the power and the wealth of the powerful and the wealthy, and basically ignoring the needs of the less fortunate. And I just couldn't tolerate that any longer. I thought that was on the wrong side of morality. So I've made the switch, and I've been a Democrat ever since. I like to call myself a centrist Democrat. I've done that, and I feel that that's the right place to be.
And Charlie, you were the chair of the Lehigh Valley Partnership for a while. Lehigh Valley Partnership, for those of you who don't know, is what I call the Lehigh Valley version of the Trilateral Commission from years ago, which is essentially the CEOs of the biggest employers in Lehigh Valley. Did they pick on you a lot? I mean, did they make jokes about it? I mean, you being the token liberal in the room, how did you get along with your peers under those circumstances?
I didn't have any trouble getting along with my peers. We didn't talk politics very often. When we did, we respectfully agreed to disagree. Richard was on that group for many, many years, and I believe, Richard, you're still on. I'm still on.
I'm not active in the Lehigh Valley Partnership. I'm more of an activist and a progressive. And I know the partnership has done some very good work, particularly in its investigations of public health and other significant issues, planning issues. So I have a lot of respect for the partnership.
Sure.
Richard, how do you come to being an activist on the liberal side of the equation and the CEO of a very successful corporation?
Like Charlie, I have roots in the Lehigh Valley, and I can remember that my uncle, Dr. Joe Brow, was the spitting image of Adlai Stevenson. Huh. And we were, the family was Democratic from the earliest time I can recall. Although when I was 10 years old, Dwight Eisenhower was the president of the United States. And in current political spectrum, Eisenhower would be considered a liberal.
Yeah, when he
Nixon resigned,
would, for that matter.
yeah, that's true. When he resigned, his farewell address was a real statement of concern, about the power of major corporate interests, the military-industrial complex.
Right.
He was much concerned about, and at that point, the military-industrial complex had about 7% of the gross domestic product. Now it has 3 or 4% of GDP. Our major concern in the United States is the healthcare complex, that where we see there are 18-19% of our total economy and growing like a weed. Those are my instincts. As far as my relationship with my peers, I see really a number of business leaders who are very much concerned with the direction the country's going in, its inability to resolve some very serious troubles that this country's facing, environmental troubles, health care, and are concerned also about the propping up our prosperity with massive federal debt and deficit financing. So you've got folks like the head of Berkshire Hathaway, Starbucks, coffee, major figures, jumping into the political discourse, which is something that is unusual in our history.
It's been interesting to see some of the biggest pushback against Trump coming from corporate CEOs and generals in our military. It's like, curiouser and curiouser, and I mean, I just don't know which way is up anymore. We're trying to figure this stuff out. What is your experience with respect to how your business operates in terms, as a result of Democratic policies versus Republican? Are they not factors, or do they drive in some way? Because, the facts show that the economy has performed better under Democratic presidents than it has under Republican presidents. But yet most business leaders are Republican and vote Republican and put their money behind Republican candidates. Do you have is there a relationship between business and especially in the current environment with Donald Trump as president, with the many ways he's really intervened in the marketplace through his tariff efforts?
Go ahead, Charlie.
Let's start with you this time.
Okay. In my business, construction, the cycle of construction is, for the jobs that we do, which are essentially the large jobs, we're doing work now at B. Braun. We're doing work at Air Products. We do a lot of the major hospital work. These projects have a life cycle of 2, 3, 4 years. So the political cycle is 2 to 4 years. A politician gets in and creates his policies, and he does it quickly, but it takes a lot of time for the economy to react to that. So in my business, the day-to-day operations in Washington in particular do really not have a big impact on the business today. It may have impact on my business 3, 4, or 5 years ago from now, but it doesn't have that much of an impact today. Hmm. Now, another thing that I'd like to point out is we live in a consumer economy, and our economy is largely dependent on the amount of money that's spent for consumer goods.
Like picture frames.
You sure?
That's correct.
We have a society where a substantial amount of the people are being repressed. From an economic standpoint, it makes no sense to keep pounding down 15 to 20% of our society. If those folks can become consumers, if they can become substantial consumers, it'll have an enormous positive effect on the economy. And if it does, then who are the people that are going to benefit the most?
The people who make those things.
That's right. It's going to be the people at the very top of the list. It's going to be the top, the 1% that we keep talking about. Those folks are going to benefit enormously if the lower 20%
can buy their product.
Have their buying power increased dramatically. I don't understand why people don't get that.
Yeah. Richard?
Yeah, Charlie is absolutely right. The economy is 70% consumer driven. I can recall in our business that 30 years ago, the leading picture frame company, it wasn't us at the time, sold tabletop picture frames in department stores. The routine price was $25 a frame. And they were very nice frames, but they were $25. You know, the cost for a tabletop frame, a desk frame, typically in the mass market is now well below $10. And that's what the consumer can afford. And overall, the quality of the product, it hasn't deteriorated in its workmanship. But it has deteriorated in the materials that are going in and the overall sort of stature of the product. You know, we're seeing really, we have this idea of that there is growth and dispersion of resources to folks. But Charlie's absolutely right. The lower economic classes are really don't have sufficient monies to disposable income to have reasonable health care, to be able to educate their kids without massive debt. It is a serious concern, and it's we're not going in the right direction.
By the way, Charlie Marcon is not just a good businessman, he's a smart guy. I mean, he went to Davidson College. Richard Masters, an attorney by training, and he's Columbia educated and Penn educated. So these guys are not just successful business people. They're very smart and are paying attention. Richard, let's get an explanation from you why you're supporting Joe Biden as president despite being the CEO of a successful company.
Let me be frank with you. I was a supporter of more progressive candidates. I'm from probably the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And I supported Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders mostly because of their support of Medicare for All, which is a big position that I advocate, an important position. I support Biden because he is going to move the country forward. He's going to address the serious problems that we have that really haven't been addressed in this administration. Trump is not a good manager. He does not have really a programmatic vision of what this country should be. He's reactive. I see him as a businessman, as a guy who sat and rather than have a strategic plan for something, if something popped up that was plump and valuable, he would run out and grab it and try to make the best of it. And I see that as his career. I've read, several books, studies of his origins and his business practices. So, you know, I think Biden will bring in the best expertise on healthcare, on the environment, on economics, and we will have we will be returning to the good government that we had under Obama, and also, you know, look, last time we balanced the budget was under Bill Clinton.
Right.
So I see that this is really a critical crossroads for the United States, you know, even from an economic perspective.
Charlie Marcon.
I agree with what Richard's saying. And one of the things that really bothers me about our the way we go about our elections, we spend years with degrading the competition. So by the time a person goes to vote, all they've heard about is the flaws of our candidates. So we end up getting in there, and we have to decide who's the lesser of two evils. And I'm really opposed to that. And one thing about when I get into that discussion with my friends about, well, Joe Biden, he's not such a good candidate. He's not such a good person. He's been around and hasn't really performed. The thing that Joe Biden is going to do when he gets elected is he's going to surround himself with some very competent people in all the necessary fields, and he's going to listen to these people.
You mean he's not going to fire them after a few weeks on the job?
Yeah, well, not only that, he's not going to fire them, and they're not going to quit on him.
Yeah,
because he's going to treat them right. Another thing that I always look at, I look at the character of our leaders. I think our leader needs to represent who we as a nation aspire to be. And Donald Trump does not have any of the characteristics of an admirable leader. And he's proven that in the last 4 years. And prior to that, he proved it. He features himself as a terrific business person. He's been bankrupt 6 times. And I can tell you from firsthand experience, when he talks about how good a negotiator is, he is not a good negotiator. Trust me. I've had personal experience with him where he thought he got the best of a deal, and I can assure you that in our dealings with the Trump organization on that particular job, we got the best end of the deal by far.
That's cool. Did you deal with him?
I did not personally deal with him.
Yeah.
One of my senior managers dealt with him, but he had a negotiation where basically Trump walked away with nothing.
That's great. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. This is WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. Over there, making sure this thing works tonight properly, is Neil Heaver. Neil is one of the reasons why this radio station exists. And Neil, I thank you for your support. Richard, you have been really outstanding in speaking out on behalf of national health care for, you know, universal health care. And I want to give you a minute to explain why you think the agenda should be going in that direction, because this is a huge issue for most Americans. And everybody's basically saying the Supreme Court is going to kill the Affordable Care Act now. And what would we want in its place?
Well, thank you, Alan. Look, I have a business in eastern Pennsylvania. We have several hundred workers in the United States. I started looking into healthcare about 7 years ago and started turning over the rocks of the healthcare system. You know, at that point, we were seeing that the increase in the cost of insuring our employees, the annual increase in healthcare premiums, was interfering with the ability of the company to provide reasonable annual cost of living and merit wage increases. And to this, it continued. Now the cost of a healthcare policy at MCS Industries for a family of one employee is over $30,000 a year. We can't allow our employees to have high deductibles because they don't have the resources to, you know, in some cases, for an $8,000 or $12,000 family bill annually. So we self-insure the deductible as well. The idea that health care is affordable today is, for most Americans, is just a pipe dream. It's not true. So we have to do something about it. And the way other countries in the world have addressed this is that they have a national health care plan. Some of them have Medicare for All, with Canada is one great example, and the Canadians love it. And there are other countries that have a more socialized view of healthcare, in which they own not the financing of the system, but also the provision of care. They own the hospitals, et cetera. We're not advocating that. Medicare for All is just a financing vehicle. The hospitals and the doctors remain private, but the care is, and the policies are comprehensive in their coverage, and as a result of the reduction in administrative cost, the overall cost of healthcare can be reduced in this country by $500 to $700 billion a year. That's an extraordinary amount when you think of a national budget of $4 trillion in that neighborhood. So I see this as an imperative. Now, you know, Biden has a very good plan, which we hope is implemented. It is an incremental approach to health care reform. It allows for the government to negotiate the cost of drugs. We hope that's extended also to other services like hospital services, very similar to the German all-payer model, where instead of these in highly inflated hospital prices that go to folks who have no insurance, and then there's an insurance negotiated price, and then there's a Medicare and a Medicaid negotiated price, and then a few percent of the people who have no insurance, the 30 million folks in the United States who have no coverage, you know, you generally get free care. We're going to eliminate that under a Biden administration with a public option, with following in the footsteps of an all-payer model. And I think we're really going to see some dramatic improvements in the overall public health of the society and the expense that goes into providing health care for everyone.
Charlie, where do you come down on healthcare? Do you have a similar view, or is there you make an argument on this one?
Well, I, I'm not nearly as sophisticated and informed as Richard, but certainly I want to make one comment. As from a business perspective, as Richard pointed out, this cost is absolutely enormous. The cost of healthcare is really, and it keeps going up, and one of the issues for me personally is, you know, my company provides health care at a very, very high level. Some of my competitors do not.
Yep.
So some of my competitors' workers get their health care through social services and so forth that are paid for by all of the people, because they're getting out of welfare. I pay for my purpose, the health care of my workers. I think that we should have an even playing field, and I should not be penalized in the competitive world because I'm providing health care to my workers. And I can
good for you, Charlie.
Well, and I would say, right. And Charlie, we appreciate you being on the show. That's Charlie Marcon, sure. From CEO of Dugan & Marcon. The thing that's always puzzled me is that the business community doesn't jump on universal health care, because that would mean currently they have to compete with each other over who's going to, offer the cheaper benefits to their employees. Why they wouldn't be thrilled to have that offloaded to the average taxpayer and everybody share in the benefit and the cost of a single payer universal health care plan, right? Right, Richard, that's where you are too, right?
Yes, yeah, I agree with you. I don't understand it, except that, there are some very wealthy business people who are concerned that ultimately they will be taxed. That is probably going to happen. Biden is saying that folks under $400,000 will not receive a tax increase in his administration. But people over $400,000 will, and corporations will be taxed more heavily. And I think that's appropriate. We were given, wealthy people were given a remarkable tax break in the Trump administration. Was it deserved? Did we deserve to get from 28% to 21% on corporate taxes, and a reduction in capital gains taxes, and a modest reduction in income taxes for the highest earners? I don't think so. Particularly in a historical perspective, when you look back to Eisenhower again, when the highest earners in the country were making we're paying so much more in taxes, 70, 80, and I don't want to say 90%, but it reached those levels. And yeah. We don't need to go back to those levels, but we do need to have a fairer distribution of the prosperity. We all of us need to enjoy the fruits of a prosperous society, and only a few of us are.
We're out of time. Richard Master, thanks so much for being with us. Richard is the CEO of MCS Industries. Tuesday, I cannot emphasize enough, Tuesday, please, when you wake up, go to the polls if you haven't already voted. This country needs its electorate to be smart, educated, pay attention, and participate. So please be part of your democracy. Vote on Tuesday and vote smart. Tonight's guests include Richard Master, who is the CEO and the founder of MCS Industries, a picture frame manufacturer in Palmer Township. Charlie Marcon, CEO of Dugan & Marcon, a family-owned business for decades, and former chair of the Lehigh Valley Partnership, and a trustee of the Lehigh Valley's biggest foundation, the Trexler Trust. You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio. I'm Alan Jennings, your host. Thanks for being with us.